Good evening.
Next, at 8:30.
And this is at Net. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. K2 K-E-Y. His name is Mel. Mel and Dick run a thing called the Technical Net. It's a gathering of the clan. We bring guys together Sunday night, and we get pretty serious about discussing ham radio for those who really like the subject. We discuss antennas and feed lines and transmitters and receivers and propagation and 25 different kinds of ham radio. We also discuss other subjects of interest to ham radio operators. Ham radio operators are curious people. So there's certain kinds of technology involving wireless computers. And in the old days, there was video cassette recorders and television, all kinds of things. High-definition television, one of our typical subjects. Tonight, most likely, Andy, WA2CDL, discussing antennas, certain kinds of stacking arrangements. Rich N2EL will be discussing audio. The S2N Paul will tell us a little bit about what happened with NASA and space. Eric, KE2EJ, our broadcasting expert, will tell us a little bit of what the world of broadcast engineering is like. Inside of every ham radio operator is somebody who wants to be a broadcaster or wants to be a scientist. I wouldn't say everyone, but a lot of them. A person signs into the Technical Net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. Give me your call letters and name at this time. K2RIW is listening.
K2EL, Rich and yes.
Rich recognized. Anyone else?
WS2N with a yes. Good evening, Dick.
Paul with a yes. It's about time. Anyone else?
Dick, WA2CDO. I'm in the garage working. I got a project I'm working on. I'll be listening, and I'll put a comment in as you discuss the antenna stacking arrangement.
Yeah, but you haven't even asked your question yet, Andy. But I got to guess as to what Andy's question is. Okay, Andy was number 3. Paul was number 2. Some guy named Rich is number 1. Anyone else?
Good evening, all. This is K2KEY.
That's Mel, number 4. We'll get to him. See? Anyone else? Give me your call letters. More than enough to get started. Rich, what's the latest in Whitestone? And keeping Jingles happy with all that fancy audio you're working on? N2EO, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, good evening, everybody. N2EO. Dick, before I go on, I hope I'm not driving it too hard. I packed everything down earlier. They're doing a lot of work here, and I realized I had the audio way up too high. Are we holding the repeater okay?
Just about right. Not too loud, not too soft, not dropping out. Have fun.
Okay, Dick, I'm glad to hear that. Yeah, I wanted to discuss audio. The reason I got into high-end audio is relates to amateur radio. A lot of hams don't get into high-end audio, but I've been involved with 75-meter AM, and I made some modifications to a Johnson Viking Ranger 2 that were published by a well-known person on AM, Tim Smith, WA1HLR, who's worked many years in the broadcast field. And he took a Johnson Ranger and made a bunch of mods to the audio stage. And I haven't actually swept it with an oscillator, but he claims that when the mods are properly done, he doesn't say 3 dB points. He says it will faithfully reproduce between 50 hertz all the way up to 15 kilohertz. So you get some pretty high fidelity AM on 70. Most of the people are operating on 75, between 3850 and 3900 in that area of the band. Anyway, so the next step was to go ahead and to try and improve the audio system. I use one mic for everything in the shack, and I use an audio switch to switch it around. And what I've done now is I've installed a Behringer 31 band equalizer, which you're listening to right now. My question, Dick, is it relates to the equalizer to the mic matching impedances, mic impedance to the input of the equalizer, the output of the equalizer to the various radios. I've been talking with Howard, WB2HWW, went to the same school you did, Pratt School of Engineering, and he feels it's not important, but I said to him, do we want to get maximum voltage transfer, maximum current transfer, or maximum power transfer? So I've been of the opinion of trying to match the input and output lines. I wonder what you think of all this.
Repeater, time out.
Yeah, during the last 30 seconds, I was listening to you on the input, Rich. You did time out the machine. But no problem. We got the general gist. Microphones and loudspeakers have a degree of similarity. Where both are acoustic transducers. Yeah, one's a transmitting device and one's a receiving device of audio. But they both convert acoustic to electrical and electrical to acoustic. I'm fairly sure that in the case of a loudspeaker, the impedance the loudspeaker sees, the electronic impedance, makes a significant difference. An ordinary loudspeaker in a usual speaker enclosure has some extremely strong resonances. In other words, there are certain frequencies at which it'll give you a pretty tubby sound and not a very flat sound. And a real good hi-fi amplifier, even though it may say this is the 4-ohm set of screws on the back, this is the 8-ohm set, this is the 16-ohm set. In other words, the voltage that comes out of there is proportional, is appropriate for that impedance of a loudspeaker. However, every good loudspeaker has something called damping factor. In other words, there's a negative feedback electronically existent within that amplifier. And if you bought some good laboratory test equipment and looked back into your hi-fi amplifier, even though you're looking at the 16-ohm terminals, you probably would see something closer to 1 ohm. In other words, the amplifier, it tries to be a nearly ideal voltage generator, a nearly short circuit. The reason for that is very similar to what happened in the old days with your triplet and your Simpson and many other kinds of Dawson Val meter movements. When you turn them to the off mode, some of the better made volt ohm milliammeters would put a short circuit across the meter movement. It's a very interesting experiment to have a meter movement in your hand and rock it back and forth and notice the way the needle will dance and bounce off of the pegs. Put a short circuit across the terminals and the meter acts in an extremely damped manner. It moves very slowly. In other words, the moving coil in the magnetic field becomes simultaneously a generator when it's trying to move, or a motor, so to speak, when you're applying voltage to it. Once you are dampening that meter by a repeater,
time out.
Good thing I'm listening, or I would have done it. When you're dampening that meter or dampening a loudspeaker, you essentially kill its resonance, and you stand much more of a chance of the loudspeaker being much more flat in its frequency response. An ideal hi-fi, you'd like it to go 15 hertz to 20 kilohertz or beyond. If you've got a real young set of ears, you can hear the difference. And having a very low impedance out of the amplifier into the loudspeaker helps you do that. Now, in the case of a microphone, if the microphone element was directly connected to your electronics, a good impedance match is probably recommended, because if the manufacturer did his job correctly, he's telling you what the performance of the microphone is going to be if it is terminated in the impedance he requested. Now, the rate at which it deviates from an ideal flat response when you put some other impedance on there, because the actual diaphragm is so much smaller in the case of a microphone, and there are kinds of microphones like Electret and capacitive-sensitive type microphones where there is virtually no real diaphragm there at all. It just is a moving object in the airstream, which changes capacitance or changes reluctance, and the rest of the electronics make sense out of it and converts it into audio. And maybe there is no natural resonance on some of the very modern super small microphones, in which case it wouldn't count so much. However, even if the wrong impedance match on the microphone is adjusting the frequency response in ways that you don't like, when you've got that Behringer 31 band equalizer, and you can properly adjust each one of those bands, I suspect you can compensate for any kind of a crime, if you know what I mean. Now, when it comes to audio, let me drop. There is a repeater on Long Island, a fairly respected repeater, that reproduces astronaut audio. And for a number of years, the astronaut audio coming out of that particular repeater was kind of muffled sounding, and a little bit difficult to understand what the astronauts were saying. Some of the acoustic equipment inside of the helmet of an astronaut is less than ideal, but if it goes through electronics that are not so ideal, it can end up pretty muffled. Joe W2RYY has put forth a significant effort, for instance, so that when he repeats astronaut audio on his 450 repeater, 448.175, you'll recognize immediately as the audio coming out of that particular repeater during the time the shuttle is in orbit sounds about the same as the audio in here out of a good hi-fi system connected to a television receive-only terminal that's listening to NASA Select. Joe has put forth a significant effort by sweeping tones through the system and making everything flat. And with proper equalization, almost anything can be made flat. And there's a lot of advantage in doing that. Human speech really requires at least 5 kc of relatively flat audio in order to be highly intelligible and pleasant to listen to. Now, an awful lot of the audio that you'll hear on 20 meters has been through extremely heavy speech processing, where the person doesn't give a darn about how distorted it sounds, and you might not even be able to recognize his voice. And if his grandmother spoke over that particular microphone and he listened to it a few miles away, he may not be able to recognize his grandmother's voice. Sometimes the speech processing is so severe. It can have extra punch. It allows you to get through a pileup. That's the good news. But the kinds of audio you hear on 20 meters on the stations that manage to get through the pileup is not the kind of audio you'd like to be putting on an FM repeater or even on a simplex channel where people are going to talk to each other. And you'd like the voice to sound somewhat like it does when you're in the same room with a guy. You don't want to have to use a tremendous amount of syntax computing within your ears to try to figure out, well, those words are so muffled I didn't hear them directly, but if I try to figure out what the possible speech syntax is, adverb probably goes here, a noun probably goes there, I think he might have said such and such. I mean, all kinds of processing goes on in your head when you're listening to very distorted audio and you're trying to figure out what the person said. And you soon realize that after 10 minutes of that, you don't want to listen to it anymore. It gives you mental fatigue to do all that processing. Speech is a pretty wicked thing to reproduce. Let me drop one more time. You've often heard it said that speech has a crest factor of 23 decibels on average. In other words, you say the word ah or some other continuous tone and you figure out what is the average power of that speech as far as the electronic signal coming out of a good microphone is concerned. But then you look at the individual puffs of air that happens when you say certain letters like T and P and whatever. The actual peak power that you supply to a microphone is about 23 decibels stronger than the average. Well, when you're going through an FM system, the average is what determines whether or not there's sufficient loudness, and those peaks would almost always be over-deviating and going beyond the steep skirts of the side lobes, of steep skirts of the bandpass filter that's in the IF system of the receiver that's listening to you. So therefore, almost every FM rig does have a kind of speech clipper built in, and I use the word speech clipper kind of softly, meaning that it does try to limit that 23 dB of crest factor to something a heck of a lot smaller. But you don't want it to be an extremely sharp, square wave clipping of the speech, because when you do that, it develops higher harmonics, it sounds raspy, and it's not pleasant to listen to. So a well-designed speech limiter that should be in every good FM rig almost sounds like it's not there. It's not perfectly natural, but at least you're not over deviating. And a couple of experiments took place this afternoon and yesterday, I guess it was, on this very repeater. A number of people talking through the repeater. We noticed that their speech was dropping out very periodically. In other words, every fifth word, a half a syllable was missing. 10% or 15% of the time, dropouts were occurring. And I talked those people into running an experiment of lowering the amount of audio in a very simple manner, backing away from the microphone or talking into the back of the mic, and the problem went away. So in other words, it leads me to believe that, yes, this particular repeater is kind of severe on how much over-deviation it will tolerate. That's the question. That's fact number one. But second of all, many of our rigs are creating peak deviations that are less than ideal or much more than they should be. So I think one of the things that Andy is possibly going to start doing, if he has the ability with his service monitor, is that on the next time he runs his tune-up clinic at the Rhyme Repeater.
Time out.
The next time Andy runs his tune-up clinic at the Rimark Functions with his service monitor, I think he ought to test a few of these rigs that were giving us a speech dropout, in which he measures not only the average deviation when a person says hello 1 2 3 4 and the amount of PL tone amplitude, but measure what is the instantaneous peak of deviation with reasonably normal audio and a reasonable normal distance to the microphone. What's the instantaneous peak that can come out of that particular rig? And when Andy runs that test, I think he's going to discover that a certain percentage of our rigs have not quite the ideal ratio between deviation after the speech monitor, audio gain in front of the speech monitor, PL tone downrange injection like it should be, not uprange, and when the peak of speech occurs out of that rig, is the PL tone also being modulated in amplitude. An ideal rig will give you a PL tone that never deviates in frequency or amplitude of PL tone, even though speech limiting is taking place on what comes out of the microphone. So the PL goes through one kind of processing, the speech goes through another kind of processing, and for all of those to be properly balanced, sound good to the human ear, have enough volume, but yet not give you an instantaneous peak that makes this a slightly persnickety repeater unhappy and starts chopping out the audio, there are ways we can get to the bottom of all this. And to have audio that's continuously being chopped out is a bit annoying to listen to. It's almost like a guy that's got an overly enthusiastic, what do we call those things now? I can't think of the name of the thing that automatically turns on your rig when you speak into the mic.
Vox.
Voice operated relay. Thank you, sir. And so you don't want the rig to sound like a 2 meter repeater audio sound like it's into an overly enthusiastic Vox. So what I think you're about to do, Rich, is find a source of tone, audio signal generator would be nice. And the old days you used to be able to buy a record. I own a 33 RPM test record, which has a series of tones on it that sweep from 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz and whatever at low, medium, and high volume and so on. There are various kinds of test instruments. I'm sure you can buy an audio CD these days that has test tones on it. And therefore, by one means or another, you can put tones into your system and find out how flat it is in order to properly adjust your equalizer network. The hard part, though, is that putting in the tone from a chunk of electronics where you inject it into the microphone port and then make everything flat beyond that, that's a necessary but not sufficient. It's a good beginning. But how is your particular microphone really responding? Well, a much more elaborate and expensive chunk of electronics is an acoustic equivalent of a human voice. It's a surrogate mouth, you could call it. I've seen these devices that you can use in an acoustic laboratory, which act like a human voice, and you can sweep it from 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz in front of your microphone. That would be the ideal way. And maybe somebody's got one of those that we can borrow. I am kind of curious, your Behringer 31 band equalizer, how much does that cost? Where did you buy it? So I see what you're doing. There's no easy answer as to what happens with impedance mismatch. I suspect each microphone is different on that. Some of those microphones have a built-in preamplifier, the preamplifier like acts like a buffer, and whether that amplifier is driving 1 ohm or 1,000 ohms, it probably wouldn't give a darn if it's the right kind of a design of an operational type amplifier. A good operational amplifier might have an output impedance of less than 1 ohm. It doesn't care what it drives as long as you don't exceed the voltage maximum or the current maximum. So some of these amplifiers, some of these modern day microphones, because of the method by which they generate the audio, have built-in preamplifiers. So I guarantee there's no flat answer to what happens with a piece of mismatch. Those are a bunch of my opinions on the subject, Rich. I'm going to pass it back to you. Drag your feet in case we've got a couple of audio experts like Eric. I mean, broadcast engineers, they really have to worry about flat audio. If we have a few people that have more smarts on them, please speak up right now. N2EO to take the repeater. N2EO to take it with a delay. TRLIW in the TechNet.
Okay, I don't hear anyone in there, Dick. I left a little extra pause in case somebody wanted to come in on echoing. What you mentioned was brought up by Hal and Howard. That Howard brought up the point that you don't want to dampen the diaphragm on the microphone. And that was one point, but we went through a lot of things, but I'm of the opinion that I do want to match the impedances. Now, Howard also brought up an interesting point, maybe do it with op-amps, because, you know, I found there's a particular transformer made by Jensen. It's called, I'm trying to remember the number, I think it's a JT11-P1. It goes from 15 cycles up to 20 kilohertz. The only drawback is I need two of them, and they're like $95 a piece. So, Howard had mentioned, I believe, there's a 5532, an op amp with a very good slew rate. I'm wondering if you think there's any advantage or disadvantage to using op amps to get, setting the input resistance and the feedback resistance and the feedback loop to get it set up so I'm seeing exactly 150 ohm input impedance, 20,000 ohms output impedance, which is the input of the varager. And the output of the varager is 150 ohms, and I have to drive a 600 ohm line with that. By the way, you asked the price. I'll leave a little pause. Not as expensive as you thought. It goes, it normally lists what, three and change, what was it now? $399. I paid $227 on Amazon.com with the shipping. It came from JNR Music right here in Maspeth, Queens. Now, what did cost some money, this microphone I'm using is not the greatest. It's a Heil Sound. It's probably better than many, but not really terrific. I went through the internet today, looking up various mics. I rented a few on eham.net, and what got very good reviews was a standard in the broadcast industry called an RE27 by Electro Voice. So I have one of those I ordered. As you can see, Dick, I'm very serious about trying to get a good signal on 75 meters AM. We're using it here on FM, on the repeater, and on the Collins KWM2, only because I use one, I don't want a pile of mics, I use one mic in the shack to run five radios with appropriate switching. So, that's the story. What do you think about using, I believe the number is a 5532 op amp? any advantage, any disadvantage? Can I get my target impedances set closer? K2RIW, Tech Net Weimark, and 2EO.
K2KEY, what a comment.
Mel recognized. Well, I've got a lot of opinions on up in. But let's see what Mel's got to say first. You got it, Mel.
Okay, no, I'm just going to make it simple. I, back in the day, I ran when those rigs were fairly new, things like the Johnson series of Rangers. I have the Viking 2. I still have the Viking 2, even though I don't use it on the air much anymore, except on the straight canine. But it worked quite well, and I used, I still got that mic, the a static D104 mic over.
I hear Julie in the background calling you. You better answer that phone. Okay. In the case of op amps, I'm going to jump over to that subject, Rich. You've heard me guys often say that a person who becomes familiar with decibels, a person who becomes familiar with a network analyzer, a spectrum analyzer, and some of the other RF radio frequency characteristics that we often discuss, you develop skills in those areas, like being able to use a Smith chart, be able to impedance match an antenna, and have more than just the ability to say what an antenna is, but have a little bit of knowledge of how to tune one and how they work, and so on. A person with that kind of training will, in today's modern high-tech world, be in demand. People with those skills are becoming rare. I'm very unhappy to see that. I've watched a number of organizations do interviewing of people who claim to have those skills, and sometimes a person knows them as buzzwords but doesn't really know them. Now, operational amplifiers are becoming the most used kind of amplifier for analog circuits and or digital circuits. When it comes to choosing an operational amplifier, you're going to have a problem. And the problem is there's a zillion of them that all look good enough. Some of the 37-cent ones that are in the bubble pack at Radio Shack can give you huge performance. I, as a kind of a cheap guy, would be very reluctant to go out and pay $90 for each individual audio transformer just to get a particular impedance match. Once you become a little bit skilled with an operational amplifier, and they're not expensive, and they can be extremely high performance for a couple of dollars, you can make the input impedance anything from milliohms to multiple megohms, inclusive. You can make the output impedance look like anything from a fraction of 1 ohm to megohm, inclusive. And you can do that independently if you're smart enough in the way you set up operational amplifiers, particularly if you use the configuration which is called an instrumentation operational amplifier. It really is just a kind of a voltage follower op amp in front of another op amp. But once you have that combination, you have complete freedom to get any input impedance you want, any output impedance you want, any reasonable amount of gain from minus 20 dB to plus 80 dB in one individual stage. Some of these op amps are thoroughly protected from overvoltage on the supply, overvoltage on the input, overloading on the output. They got all kinds of self-protect circuits in there. About the only way you can damage them is hit them with a small lightning bolt, so to speak. Some of the modern ones are extremely low in noise, extremely high in gain, extremely accurate.
Repeater, time out.
Almost all of those characteristics I described, as input impedance, output impedance, gain, and so on, inverting, not inverting, all of that can be done by just setting up a couple of resistors on the outside of that op-amp. In fact, there are op-amps where you can have a voltage variable gain function, logarithmic gain functions, and whatever. So to become skilled with an op-amp is a very valuable thing to do. I'm trying to think of the name of the company now that sells a beautiful $40 book online. The book is 8.5 by 11 format, about 1.5 inches thick. Not acoustic research, it's something like that. I'll have to walk over to my shelf and pick up the darn book. I can't think of the name of the book right now, but I'll come back with that information sometime in the near future. You buy that book, and read its eight individual chapters. Mr. Jung wrote a couple of very good books, J-U-N-G, on operational amplifiers. There's a little bit of introduction with a couple of errors in the Radio Amateur's Handbook on operational amplifiers. There should be more of that. When it comes to modern-day audio amplification, IF amplification, video amplification, power supplies, regulators, all of these are subsets of operational amplifiers. And let's do a couple of words as to what an op amp is. It really is an amplifier that has a tremendous amount of internal gain. Quite often 100 decibels of gain in one individual little 50-cent package. You can make it run on a single power supply, like plus 5 volts, or dual power supply, plus or minus 10, plus or minus 15. You have tremendous amounts of freedom as to what you give it and how you use it. It's got a tremendous amount of internal gain, quite often 100 decibels and greater. You set a feedback resistor around it, and the resistor would make the gain anywhere from unity to 80 of those 100 dB. We like to have 20 dB of leftover. By feedback theory, the amplifier is continuously monitoring what it puts out, comparing it to what you put in, and adjusting itself so that the waveforms track. It cancels its own distortion, so to speak. So what you get out of it, in most cases, is extremely linear copy with extra gain or impedance matching or voltage following or buffering or whatever of what you put into it. In the old days, when I cut my teeth on operational amplifiers in roughly 1970, the 741 op amp was very popular in those days. And to use it beyond, let me pick a number, 10 kilohertz, it started falling off in performance. Modern-day op-amps, some of them will go to 1,000 megacycles. So there's a great big overlap in what used to be called RF amplification and analog or audio and power supply. I mean, they're all folding together as far as what op-amps can do. So will the op-amp do it? Hands down, no question. Is it the right way to do it compared to a transformer? Without a doubt. And can it give you all the isolation? There are even kinds of op-amps that have photo-coupled isolators built into them, so you can get all the advantage of a transformer without any of the disadvantages of a transformer. So that's a beautiful approach. I strongly recommend it. The $300 you spent for your Behringer equalizer, by my standards, that's a little bit pricey. But you're a man of more means than I am, Rich. So have fun. Sounds like you're doing the right thing. And Electro Voice RE27 sounds like a real good microphone. I know the mic I'm using on this rig could be better. One of these days I'm going to do some experimenting with audio. Anybody want to put in any final comments on what we've said so far before the repeater?
Time out.
Before I go over to our second guy, Paul, give me your comments right now. K2RIW. Okay, Eric. Eric, tell us about op-amps, audio, mics, equalization. How does Rich, if he wants to really be a purist, how does he get a surrogate throat to really test the frequency response of his mic and the whole rest of the system? KE2EJ, our broadcast engineer, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Actually, I have an RE27. I use it on the other radio. I like it. But reality is, what's the bandwidth of the system you're working with, you know? I mean, if the system rolls off at 3 kilohertz and doesn't start till 300, you know, 300 hertz, what's the point of going out there and getting a microphone that's got a real natural sound, really flat looking from, you know, 20 hertz to 18 and 17 kilohertz? You know, most of that's thrown away. So, there's that reality. Oh, but you were talking about with the repeater. I was actually going to head there today, but there was a stuck in a traffic accident, and I didn't feel like getting up there. Probably go up there tomorrow. We got two issues going on. We got a tone decoder that's not terribly sensitive, but has some hysteresis to it. Previously, Andy decided he wanted to change something, so we put the old phone decoder back. I knew what the problem that was going to lead to. We have a different kind of tone decoder that has a quick response time, that almost no hysteresis, no delay on it. And then there's the issue of whether or not the RF and the detector is actually centered in the bandpass. So You know, I can't blame all of you up there. I can find a book. You know, really check the rear end out, make sure everything's right. Because if it's off to one side, it's going to give us those kinds of problems that you're talking about. And there are some videos, of course, that don't put out a heck of a lot of tone. So, you know, the tone decoder did a better job. So, at the very least, I'll probably put that back and see if we can add a little time constant to it. And he won't be unhappy about the fluttering that it does. Yeah. That this one doesn't do, but it just chops you out to get too much peak deviation. As far as broadcasting goes, the name of the game, really, is to be as flat as possible until you get to the transmitter's processor. And the idea there is to create the maximum amount of loudness so that you can beat out the other station, especially in AM. So they do these weird tricks to try and make that RF peak as much as they possibly can without creating distortion, which is the trick. I'm going to drop a repeater.
Time out.
Oh, just good timing. There's a lot of things you can do. I mean, if you're talking about FM, like 2 meters with, you know, 5 kilohertz with the deviation, you can play the game of increase the, you've got really nice graphic equalizers, you can increase the low end, increase the high end a little bit, leave the mid-range down a little bit, give it a little bit of a beefier, more sibilant sound. But you are talking communications-grade quality here, whereas what Rich is really talking about, I think, is on 80 meters. Where it's going to be real AM, that's where it'll pay off. And op-amp side, a fan of the LF series of op-amps, you know, multi-hundred mega-ohm input impedance. It's actually got FETs at the front end, and most op-amps are DC-coupled, dual differential amplifiers, so you can do a lot of fun stuff with it. Depends upon what package you're buying. If you're buying a 741, or you're buying, you know, 5558, 6883, there's a whole series that audio people like to use because they tend to have very low noise floors. The thing in really good quality audio, they always use a split supply because they want the audio to sit around the ground, not at some weird voltage. K2RWK2K.
Yeah, by having a split power supply, meaning running on plus or minus 10 or plus or minus 15, numbers like that, as opposed to being single-ended, which forces you to use DC offset characteristics or capacitive coupling. Op-amps can work extremely well with direct coupling with no capacitors at all. And there are times when that's the right way to do it. One of the op-amps, the series that I was using, made by Texas Instruments, I can't think of the model number right now, has dual differential input and dual differential output, and I cascaded 3 or 4 of those stages. The advantage of having that kind of dual everything is it becomes extremely common mode insensitive. Hump pickup between your twisted pair that goes between the stages, so to speak, becomes essentially non-existent. And I was designing a system where I was literally counting electrons. I was building a circuit that could accurately measure 10 to the minus 5 picofarads.
That's cool. You could use OPA. The OPA series is very quiet like that.
Now, I needed more than quietness. I also needed high speed and dual differential everything. But 10 to the minus 5 picofarads. Let's see. 10 to the minus 3. A picofarad is 10 to the minus 12. 10 to the minus 3 picofarad is a femtofarad. I was measuring attofarads. I was getting to the point where I was literally measuring 17 electrons on each half cycle. Building an extremely sensitive Wheatstone bridge detector circuit that was sniffing an extremely weak signal out of the with a synchronous demodulator. And I set it up to fall up with the dual differential up amp. And if that project ever turns into something, you'll be hearing about it someday because it's got a beautiful application. And what it's capable of doing, I guess can even possibly end up in broadcast someday. All right, so learning op-amps is the right thing to do. They're not too difficult if you got the right book. There are some paperback books for a couple of...
You know, the best beginners is Don Lancaster's The Op-Amp Cookbook.
Okay, that sounds like a good one. Don Lancaster's Cookbook. Also, Burr Brown has a very good set of books because they were essentially the inventor of op-amps way back in the dark ages of the 60s and 70s, 1960, 1970 series. And so third generation techniques by Burl Brown is a very good classic oldie but goodie. Without amps, you can make yourself an extremely precision sine wave oscillator, triangular wave oscillator, square wave oscillator, logarithmic amplifier, power supplies, voltage followers, sample and hold networks. It just goes on and on and on. Anything you can imagine with a quasi-analog, quasi-digital circuit, if you're smart enough, you can make it out of op-amps. And the amplifiers themselves used to cost you $1 zillion. Nowadays, you buy them for less than a dollar, and they got better performance. It's a little bit similar to what happens when Neil Armstrong talks about the fact that he had this extremely expensive, state-of-the-art computer that helped him land on the lunar surface. Your cell phone these days has got a hell of a lot more computing power than what he used to navigate to the moon and land on the moon and get back home again. So we've come a long way, and it's time we take advantage of that. Let's find out what Paul's got to say. WS2N, hey Paul, you sometimes got some real interesting questions, and I'll bet you we got a little bit of knowledge about what's going on with NASA these days. WS2N, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, well, Paul, I'll have a NASA report later. But I just wanted to go over something we talked about a week or two ago about the LCD screens versus the LED screens. You were saying, well, I made a comment about the LEDs. I wanted to find out, you know, if anybody knew the complications that are involved with the wiring. I saw him figured out the printed boards that what's really involved with these things. But I did actually see LED HDTVs, what to look for. And they are pricey, that's twice the price of the LCD screen. You know, most of the people are, I talk to the guy, most of everybody's buying the LCD, but the new thing now is the LED screen. And some of them are, I feel, very big in a 50, 55 inch diameter range. And what it is, I was looking at two of them made by the same company, and they were side by side, and they were exact same size. And I tell you, I could not see the difference between one or the other. Could not see it. And as much as I tried, I looked close, I looked far away. But I'm just curious about these. You know, these, we talked about, the topic was really LEDs. I don't want to time it out, Dick. And, you know, that's where I brought up the incredible amount of what I think would be LEDs inside some of these TVs. And, you know, if you take, like, you know, 1080, well, the ones I was, you know, was looking at were 1080, and then that 1940 or something the other way, you're looking at a couple of million pixels. But to get the three colors, that's what I was wondering about. To get the three colors in each pixel that you would really need, to do that, you would actually need like the equivalent of 6 million LEDs in one TV screen. I'm wondering if anybody's ever thought about that, what's involved with it. Is it true that, the original colors were what, red, green, one was reverse polarity, or was straight polarity, and then they had the yellow ones, which were, I think they were operated just, with an AC type of thing, not a direct current. So you've got all these complicated currents involved, and wondering about this whole deal. It's many thousands of dollars worth. There is an advantage of it. I looked at the width of it, and the width is like maybe an inch and a quarter, tops an inch and a half on the thickness of the LEDs compared to the LCD, which are maybe 3-4 inches. And also, apparently they throw off less heat. If you put your hand, like the back of your hand there, they're giving off more. It seems like it anyway. I haven't seen the specs. It seems like it's giving off less heat. So that's the topic, Dick. Back to you. This is WS.
Yeah, I'm going to have a series of questions for Eric on this, and let me set it off by my tiny bit of understanding. To my knowledge, a liquid crystal display, LCD display, has individual pixel-like elements where when you apply voltage to it, little bitty particles inside of a capsule change their polarity, and the signal does or doesn't come through the screen. The signal itself is a light source behind the liquid crystal screen, which in the old days was a compact CCFD, compact fluorescent display. That was the source of light, and the light was being smeared across the whole back of the display, and individual pixels were changing their transparency to give you the display. Now, there's a version of that where the cold cathode compact fluorescent tube is being substituted by an array of, let me call them, white light-emitting diodes. So light-emitting diodes are now feeding the LCD screen, and is that called an LED screen is an interesting question. I'm having trouble believing, just like you, that millions and millions of little light-emitting diodes themselves are directly distributed on that screen. I just don't think we've gone that far yet, but I bet you Eric is going to bring us up to speed on all of this. KEQEJ, I hope you're there. KQRIW.
K2RIW, K2J. Now, the one thing that you left out from the liquid crystal display is that there's a polarizer. And the actual individual cells in the liquid crystal actually is being activated by an AC signal. You're changing the duty cycle. And as you do that, you change the actual axis in which the light passes through it, and the polarizer takes from light to dark. It's more complicated with color, but that's the basic concept. Even with compact fluorescent tube, in between that and the LED display, and there are actually a couple of sets that were made that you could look through, that you could actually use the daylight and see the screen from both sides, which is kind of cool. But there's a diffuser with a different piece of oval glass, a piece of plastic. A piece of plastic that doesn't allow for the brightness to center itself on in one particular place. It actually evenly distributes the light across the face of it. And there are different forms of LEDs. There's what's called OLEDs, or organic LEDs, and the reason why they're using those is it's able to create the exact wavelength that you want so the eyeball will see when you're making a color picture. There are made from traditional LEDs, and they throw off lots of heat. Again, they go through a diffuser, a piece of opal glass, or whatever kind of plastic that they're using, and that makes you even distribution across the backplane. So, the good thing about the OLEDs is that you're more able to spectrally tune the output to give you a more pleasing image to the eyeball. K2RW, K2RW.
Okay, so it sounds like even the LED-like displays really are using a LCD in the variable transmission mode by a polarizer in order to really trace the image on the screen. Give us a couple of words, if you think we'll understand it, as how a liquid crystal display screen is able to produce color. Are there really... The source of illumination, whether it be a cold cathode, compact fluorescent, basically a fluorescent tube, just like the 40-watt long tube that we have in our houses in some places, but it's a more small version of that, or light-emitting diodes. I presume nobody is really using light-emitting diodes as the individual pixels, but how do we take that essentially white source of light and make it present various colors on various portions of that screen that we look at? I'm having trouble believing that the liquid crystals are being built in the triple sets of red, green, and blue. Give us a couple words on that, Eric. K2EJ, K2LIW.
Did he confirm that, Dick? Did Eric confirm that? I'm just wondering. Is that true? There is no true LED screens then? Correct.
I think so, but let's let Eric go with it. You got it, Eric.
Well, actually, that's not true. There are LED screens, but not the way you think, and not the, what you can cost, but what you would be able to afford to buy at this point. There's a problem in terms of, you know, reducing the size of the die. Actually, most of the sports displays that you see, believe it or not, there's a high brightness LED displays where the pixel is set of three LEDs in a cell. They actually have made displays on a small scale of individual LEDs, and but they've not brought that into the widespread use of a consumer set because A, the heat problem, B, it's expensive, C, there's other issues. But there are two new types of devices coming out, one which actually has a cell and phosphor in it, that the original phosphors of the tube. That should be coming around, I guess, after the new year. And then there is another form of display, which is another excited phosphor, and that should be coming around pretty soon. That's even thinner, and it produces more light, and it doesn't have the issues of the liquid crystal screens, whereas you're starting to see now sets that refresh at 120 hertz to 240 hertz. You know, which adds a lot of price to the product, but it also actually reduces the amount of mosquito noise and the other wonderful artifacts that come with digital television. When you break up an analog picture into little boxes, you don't realize that there's little square edges for every piece of picture that's there, and basically it's up and down. There ain't no diagonal in television. You have to kind of fake it.
KC2QNQ.
Glenn recognized. Can you give us a couple of words, Eric, though, before we leave you, on how does a liquid crystal display screen, whether it be a laptop or a television set, how does it really create the whole spectrum of what you and I would call red, green, and blue? Over to you.
It's real simple. On the back, there's this hunk of plastic, which is actually thin little stripes of red, green, and blue filters. What it essentially does, if you take a magnifying glass and go look at a liquid crystal display, you'll see that it's made of what looks like these very fine little slots. That three of these slots that make up a square pixel. One's red, one's green, one's blue. You make them all the same intensity, you get light. And as you change the relationships between one another, you get the entire color spectrum. And each one of those red, green, and blue stripes that looks like a pixel is actually three cells that make up a pixel. So, you know, it's just like your tri-dot phosphor TV set. K2RW, KU2J.
The way those vertical stripes of red, green, and blue transparent plastic taking the light source into individual, I guess, vertical stripes, does it have some similarity in operation to the Sony Trinitron tube? Go ahead.
You can think of it in terms of the end result is practically the same. The methodology that makes it work is very different. You're really talking about a sandwich of glass that's got some stuff etched in the front of it, and in that sandwich is a liquid, which actually has crystals in it, which are actually nice polarizing devices. And you feed a nice vibrating square wire in there, and it makes them crystals stand in one direction, and if you change the duty cycle of it, you'll make the crystal go the other way. People think that the crystal itself is what goes black, but it's not. It's the polarizing filter. You take away the polarizing filter, you don't see anything. That's just the reality of it. By the way, they use transparent material, transparent conductors, to actually make magnets in each one of those cells. I think it's tin oxide, indium tin oxide, I think it is. It's a transparent conductor. You can literally paint on the glass. So there's a lot of neat tricks when it comes to manufacturing liquid crystals. Today, the culmination of all our technology is actually producing some very nice-looking images. K2RW, K2J.
Do you happen to know the approximate conductivity of indium tin oxide? Is question number one. And I had another one, but it escapes me. Back to you, Eric.
I don't actually know, but I could look that up. I believe it's in the order of several ohms per millimeter. something like that. You know, even in this kind of thing. So we're talking all high impedance stuff, you know, even if the thing was, you know, 100 ohms per inch, it really wouldn't matter much.
Now, organic LEDs, what makes them organic? Why are they better? Why are they called organic? I'm having trouble believing that those crystals are really alive.
Although I wouldn't doubt it. Over to you, Eric. Okay, you know, I will tell you this. Organic is what is normally we deposit when we make a piece of substrate. We deposit various different gases, or we place them into various different gases at various different stages of development. And these deposits either make the holes, the barriers between the various different layers. And it just so happens that the layer where the oscillating is going on, which most people will get, an LED is an oscillator. It's just that instead of antimony or indium or arsenic or the various other doping agents that they use, I don't know exactly, you know, I'm going to look it up, but I can give you an exact answer, but there's various other doping agents that come from organic growth that are these compounds that are used as doping agents. It allows them to precisely tune the frequency of the oscillator. Does that help?
Yes, I think it does. Hey, Glenn, what would you like to know about all this? KC2QIQ, C2LAW.
It's interesting. This week we had a similar discussion, and I had a chance to run into a few people that are kind of LED experts. And a lot of the questions that were brought up here tonight, actually, I got firsthand information. And LED screens, as far as being used for the general public right now, they are being used presently on basically touch iPhones, like your Apple iPhone. Also, Samsung has a generation of touch phones as well. So wherever you're seeing these portable displays on telephones, you can actually see that they're using actual light-emitting displays. They're not backlit with a light tube and a LED off on the side. So disadvantages to the LED as opposed to the LCD. The efficiency is about 40% worse than the light tube version, so it doesn't quite seem as if they're going to be replacing the LCD screens just yet. It's got a little bit more development to go. Organic LEDs is a film substrate that actually is organic, that's doped on top of the standard LED. So the LED is on the bottom, but if you take the light focusing part, you can actually control the color by making almost an array or a prism effect on top of a standard LED. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, I got a little explanation for you here. Go right ahead, Eric. All right, just remember, this is an oversimplification to the general public. An OLED is a layer of organic material that's sandwiched between two conductors, an anode and a cathode, which are in turn sandwiched between a top, a glass top plate, which is the seal, and a glass bottom plate, which is the substrate. When an electric current is applied to the two conductors, a bright electroluminescent light is produced directly from the organic material. Okay, that's an oversimplification, but OLED has more control over color expression because it only expresses pure colors when an electric current stimulates the relevant pixel. LED primary color matrix is arranged in red, green. This is referring to an OLED display. You know, it's combined in red, green, and blue pixel. Each individual OLED element is housed in a special microcavity structure designed to greatly reduce the ambient light interference and works to improve overall color and contrast, etc., etc., etc. And then they finally say that the three colors are further defined by a color filter which purifies each color without the need for a polarizer, rendering outstanding color purity. I don't know exactly what they mean by that, but we can find out.
Okay, we're getting slowly smarter. I've got a flat screen display. Multimedia is the brand name of an expensive one. Sceptor, S-C-E-P-T-R-E. Brand name, which I've been using for the last year or two on my desktop computer. When I run my finger across the screen,
I will see what I call a wake behind my finger, a black wake behind my finger, as if I'm displacing a viscous fluid of some kind, and for a few milliseconds after my finger passes, the amount of light illuminated changes drastically.